This episode is brought to you by Glorify, the number one Christian daily devotional app. Everything around us changes. God doesn't. That's why I love Glorify's 21-day challenge. It helps me build a simple habit of meeting with God every day. No pressure, just consistency. With Glorify, you can start your morning by reading the Bible passage of the day, diving into Glorify's daily devotional, and wrapping up with an immersive experience called Daily Walk with God. And if you need to take a few minutes to yourself in the middle of a busy day, try one of Glorify's guided meditations or listen to their curated worship playlists for some quiet reflection. To end the day, enjoy Glorify's sleep meditations to help you wind down and put your mind and heart at ease. Whether you're a committed Christian or simply curious about faith, Glorify has something for you. Join over 20 million people who have downloaded the Glorify app and deepened their relationship with God. Listeners to the show can get full access to Glorify for just $29.99 for the entire year. That's Glorify's lowest price ever when you download the Glorify app now at glorify-app.com/redcircle. Feel closer to God this year with Glorify. Get full access all year for just $29.99 at glorify-app.com/redcircle. That's glorify-app.com/redcircle.
Carvana's so easy, just a click, and we've got ourselves a car. See?
So many cars. That's a clicktastic inventory.
And check out the financing options. Payments to fit our budget. I mean, that's
Clickonomics 101.
Delivery to our door?
Just a hop, skip, and a click away.
And bought.
No better feeling than when everything just clicks. Buy your car today on
Carvana.
Delivery fees may apply.
Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
Welcome, dear listener, to episode 406 of the Gravity Commons Podcast. I know what episode this is because last week we talked about how it was episode 405. And I don't even remember what we were saying. I think we were joking around about how surely nobody has listened to all 405 episodes.
I have. Hi, yes. I'm here too. I'm here too, Ben.
Listen, though, you probably haven't listened to them all. Like you participated in the recording of most of them. But do you actually re-listen to the episode every time they come out? I have to admit I don't.
No, but you know, do you read... You don't have to read your autobiography.
True, but you know, I think reading your autobiography is different than writing it. So I think recording the episode is different than listening to the episode. Anyway, I'm just I'm getting hung up on the technicalities here. Anyway, I was like, well, maybe somebody has. And so if you have listened to all 405 episodes, which was last week, I said go ahead and email us. And honestly, I expected zero people to email us, but we did get one email from somebody named Claire who believes that she has listened to all 405 episodes of the podcast. She says that when she left Santa Barbara in the fall of 2019, I drove around the West Coast for 3 months looking for a place to live. And the Gravity Podcast came to my attention because we had somebody on that she knew about. And then, During my many hours on the road, I listened to every podcast beginning with the first one. And then after she finally settled down where she lives now, I look forward to listening every week while usually hiking or working out at the gym. And she believes that she has listened to every single episode of the podcast.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyway, we're going to send her a book. She's already has our book, Having the Mind of Christ, which is what we promised. But she requested a copy of God Can't by Thomas Ord, which is those are a couple episodes. I can't remember how long ago they were, but they were very compelling for me and caused a lot of thoughtfulness, apparently for Claire too.
Well,
congratulations to Claire, everybody. Let's give it up. Let's give it up for Claire.
Where's your cheer button?
Oh no, that was the wrong button. I really need to label these. That's the little theme music. That's the laughter.
Don't laugh at her.
There it is. There it is. That's for you, Claire.
Hey, let's run it back and see if your brother will edit this. Let's give it up for Claire.
Hey, very good. Very good.
It's not going to be edited.
It's not going to be edited. No. This is how it's going to be. So anyway, yeah, congratulations. I was actually very, Claire was in a cohort, Gravity Formation cohort with me a while back. And I really enjoyed getting to know her. So anyway, congrats, Claire. Way to go.
Yeah. Ben, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. I think, you know, I it's probably, we've probably talked about this before, but I have a lot of allergies. I am what they, I am what they call polysensitized. So, yeah. And that doesn't, I don't think that has anything to do with, gender identities or things like that. But anyway, I'm very sensitive to a lot of allergens indoors and outdoors. And I think we just recently decided I'm going to try immunotherapy.
Oh,
which
you
is,
are?
Which is like allergy shots. Yeah, like you have to do it for 5 years to get relief. But like 83 to 85% of the people who, they basically make a, they make a cocktail of all the stuff you're allergic to and they give you a small dose of it. I mean, it works just like a vaccine kind of. And you gradually over 5 years, you build up an immunity to all the things that you're allergic to. And so anyway, that's the hope. That's the dream.
Yeah. And then what's going to happen? What's your best life?
Yeah. I imagine I'll, you know, suddenly feel, you know, 20 years younger and we'll be able to climb mountains in a single leap.
Okay.
Things like that. No, I don't know. I just hope I feel better and I'm less bothered by things like cats and dust and pollen and things like that.
And planet Earth.
Planet Earth. So I can just like go outside anytime I want, you know, and mow the lawn without trouble. So,
yeah.
So anyway, I think I'm going to try it.
Good.
So that's the latest with me.
Yeah.
Well, how are you? Man. How are you?
Well, I went to a concert last night, as you know, because you led a meeting in my stead at our church. And, it was the first time in weeks that the heat has been under oppressive here in Indiana and, sat outside, listened to Gregory Alan Isakov.
Yeah, that's a it was a nice night for a concert.
Nice night. He was fantastic. He was fantastic. You would have liked this show. Anyway, it was great.
I like a lot of shows. Yeah.
I know. The only thing that would have made it better was a trumpet, but I think a trumpet improves almost every concert.
Yeah. Just a random trumpet, just somebody brings one in the crowd.
Not random. They won't let you bring that in.
Oh, okay.
They would confiscate your random trumpet. I'm talking mostly about trumpets on stage. It's very selective, artistically crafted use of trumpet in songs.
Yeah.
I think is my favorite. I think it is.
Yeah. Now, do you just the trumpet or do you like a little horn section?
Any kind of, I mean, I'll take trombones.
Okay.
Trumpets. I'll take even a, you know, it doesn't get enough play is a good French horn in a song. I think it's more difficult.
Yeah. When it's not like an orchestral arrangement.
Right.
What was I going to say about trumpets? Oh yeah. I agree about trumpets. And for some reason it made me think of, do you remember that song? I think it might've been one of the first songs off Radiohead's album, Kid A. I think it was the song called The National Anthem. Anyway, I'm a listener. If you'd like to correct me, I'm open to it. But I think it was the National Anthem. It was a Radiohead song. And like right at the end of the song, this horn section comes in. And I remember laughing out loud at how delighted I was at that. I was like, that is crazy and awesome. And it works.
Wow.
Yeah. If I had it queued up, I could play it for us all, but we'd probably get in copyright trouble.
Don't do that. We should maybe, or maybe I should say this. You know what won't get us into copyright trouble?
publishing an interview that we did ourselves.
Yeah, with
Mark Alan Shelsky.
Alan Shelsky.
Yeah.
He's been a full-time pastor since 1985 and is currently the teaching elder of Bridge City Community Church in Portland, Oregon. He tells some of the story, actually, in this interview about being a pastor of that church. He also hosts the Apprenticeship Way podcast and is the author of The Wisdom of Your Heart and Discovering Your Authentic Core Values, as well as the book we're talking about today, Journaling for Spiritual Growth. Astute listeners, especially Claire, who's listened to all the episodes, will recognize that we've talked to Mark about this book in the past. He's reissuing a second edition with more information about how to be still and silent. Mm-hmm. Journaling, I think, has never been more crucial as we seek to regulate ourselves and open ourselves to God. So with great joy, we bring you this conversation.
You know, one more caveat about this conversation. Oh, you'll notice at the beginning that Mark says, hi, I'm glad to be here. And he mentions me by name because at the beginning of this interview, I was there in the interview. But sadly, I was lost to a bad internet connection. And so anyway, you'll hear Mark reference me and then I don't think you'll hear from me again. So don't be confused don't be alarmed. I'm okay. I just got kicked out of the room. I was not silenced, at least not on purpose. I was silenced by a bad internet connection. And that's all. So
right, no conspiracies.
Yeah, no conspiracies to silence me.
All right, man.
Yeah. All right. Let's get into it. Here we go.
Mark Shelsky, welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Matt, thank you so much for the kind welcome. Glad to be here with you again.
Yeah. Mark, we've had you on the podcast a number of times, and I thought it would be nice, maybe by way of a more protracted introduction, just to hear a little bit about your life. I know that you not only write things, but you also do other stuff as well. Mark, you tell us about your church a little bit.
Yeah. Let's see. I'm a pastor, a small church pastor here in Portland, Oregon. Fun, exciting, weird place to be a Christian pastor. Bridge City Community Church is entering its 28th year. And I've been a part of it in one way or another since about 6 months in. So this church really has been kind of the context of the majority of my adult spiritual journey. You know, I grew up in the church. Dad was a pastor. I was not planning to be a pastor. Had a whole other life planned for myself. Was going to be an architect and studied to prepare for that. And then had the kind of mystical experience that we often talk about, that calling experience that suddenly made architecture feel like a trivial endeavor next to being a part of helping kids at that point. My early experience, like many of us, was with youth ministry and helping kids have a more beautiful understanding of Jesus, a more freeing understanding of Jesus. And that was just so compelling to me, so meaningful to me. And so I kind of began that path. So I, trained in the ways that you do, went to school, got a theology degree, interned in various churches, ended up working in a large church that, 2 years into that experience, went through a cataclysmic church split. When I came on staff, there were 11 pastoral staff members. When I left after the split, there were 3. And of those 11, 2 of us are in ministry still. It was a formational experience for me because I had never seen or experienced anything like that at all. And really challenged me to think a lot about what is this thing, church? What is this thing that we're up to here? And how ought it work? And what ways are more like the ways of Jesus? And what ways are tied up in power and politics and people feeling strong and in control of things like the kitchen, you know, all those weird church games that people play. And one of the fruits of that explosion was a small group of families that kind of decided to opt out of that and began meeting in a home. They were just folks, no pastor, you know, just folks that had been part of the church and decided to kind of use as their focus the old classic Blackaby Bible study, experiencing God. And just together as a group proceeded through that study. And at the end of that study, kind of looked up from the book and looked around the circle and decided that maybe they indeed were a church already. And that is the seed of what became Bridge City Community Church. Mm-hmm. And so I've been, you know, a part of this body, you know, for a long time. I'm 54. So, you know, at this point, what, more than half my life?
Man. Yeah.
And in that time, Bridge City has been, I would say, four different churches. There's a through line for sure. There's an evolution. There's a development of ethos that goes through the whole thing, but it's had four kind of different seasons with a unique character, a specific demographic of people that were deeply involved, and size. And, you know, each of those seasons presented its own challenges and lessons. And we're in, I think, now the beginning of the fifth season. And I don't know if this fifth season is the beginning of a new thing, that if we were to have a check-in conversation 5 years from now, I could say, look, that was a turning point moment. And, you know, Bridge City has matured into this exciting new thing. Or if we're in a situation that is just, you know, I hesitate to use the word hospice, but, you know, a situation where I'm chaplaining a church that is small and may not ever be more than what it is now. And if I had to say that sentence 15 years ago, it would have killed my ego. But today, I'm quite content. In fact, I'm deeply enjoying the work of ministry in this little community, where the folks who are there because they want to understand and practice the other-centered co-suffering way of Jesus. And many of them are on their, like, last nerve with the church, right? They've been through all the other stuff that doesn't feel very Jesus-y. And somehow they've ended up in our little community and discovered that it's possible to have a church community that functions without manipulation, without guilt and shame, without heavy expectations of ownership of your time, with trust that the Spirit is working in you at the pace and time that the Spirit desires to work in you. And that doesn't need to look like you being anything. You don't need to sing the songs a certain way. You don't need to demonstrate some kind of outward appearance. You don't have to show up a certain number of times in order to qualify. Like, if you're here, the assumption is on good faith that the Spirit is at present and at work in you, and we're going to walk this next little leg of the journey together. And it's been shocking to me personally how the weight has shifted from the time when I felt my calling was to build something for the kingdom and to spin the plates necessary to make this thing happen, to now where my calling is to show up and to bring the best version of who I am that day, trusting that the Spirit is also at work in me and that whatever happens in this community is not contingent on my performance, but is a gift that the Spirit offers us. It's taken me 27 years of active ministry in this body to get to that place.
I wonder if you could reflect a bit on how'd you get there? Are there seminal key moments that helped you become that kind of person?
Yeah, for sure. I would say in overview, it's a partnership between trauma and intention. I have always had an intuition, I think, that the life of faith is meant to be this kind of beautiful, generative community. Yeah. I think that the seeds of that came from being a pastor's kid in a small church community where people did take care of each other. Even though it was a fundamentalist community, there was something really rich and meaningful where people watched out for one another, took care of one another, invited you to invest and to share your gifts. And then probably the next formative moment, I went as a kid to a little tiny low rent sleepaway summer camp that was owned by our church denomination. I started at 8 years old, went every summer for a week. As soon as I was of the age where I could go for 2 weeks, I would go for 2 weeks. When I became old enough to be a junior counselor, I became a junior counselor. When I became old enough to be a staff member, I became a staff member. So I was at this little summer camp in some capacity every summer for, I would say, certainly 10 years. And it was not a big fancy summer camp. You know, it didn't have a lake. It didn't have fancy equipment. Everything that we did was made out of, you know, spit and paper mache. Everything that we did, there was no budget, right? You know, like one summer I showed up as a staff member and the director was like, well, our archery teacher bailed on us. So guess what? You're the archery teacher. Well, I've never done archery. Here's the key to the archery cabinet. Here's the Boy Scout manual for archery. Kids show up in 10 days, right? You know, and that was just the way that it worked. But the experience of it was that here was a group of folks that were sharing a mission, right? To give these kids an incredible summer. And because it was a little Christian summer camp, to help them experience Jesus in that process. And so we all shared that mission, but we all had different gifts, people working in the kitchen, people working in the horse barn, lifeguard at the pool, you know, we're all doing our thing. We all have our gifts, but we're all pulling in the same direction. And, you know, everybody has a place. It immediately felt like family. I remember as a, you know, in the final summers, as I was an adult, you know, became assistant director at one point, driving the, you know, 3.5 mile gravel road from the rural highway to the camp facility and just turning onto that road and feeling in my body that sense of home, that sense of I'm in my place, I'm with my people. And something about that, I think, shaped the way I think of what church should be, right? That we share a mission, and regardless of our gifts or skills or experience, we're on the same team, pulling in the same direction. Some days you're going to function out of your very best gifts, like when I was on stage playing my guitar, and some days you're going to function because it's what's needed, like when I had to learn how to shoot a bow and arrow, having never done it before. Yeah. You know, and you're doing that because you care about these folks that you're serving. You want them to feel loved, to feel welcomed, to feel seen, you know, to maybe experience Jesus and all of it. And I think that has really been a template for me in my whole life. But as I got into the role of pastor, I also came with all of my story and baggage, right? So I'm a first child. I'm an adopted first child. My dad died traumatically when I was 11. My particular cocktail is high performance. My productivity is my rent on existence. If I provide you with the best possible service, you will want me at your table.
Yeah.
Right. So that's all wrapped up in this package. So on the one hand, I have this picture of what church can be that I think is really precious. And on the other hand, I have this internal drive that I have to create, I have to make, I have to manufacture, I have to produce this for you, for the kingdom, but also for my sense of secure identity.
Sure.
Right. And so, you know, I did that, right? My package of life wires me up to be good at what I do, right? I don't mean that as an arrogant statement. I mean that I have the toxic drive to become excellent at what I do because that was necessary for a sense of secure identity.
Yes.
And so I did that and got lots of affirmation for it and sort of matured up the ladder of ministry until at one point was asked to be senior pastor of this little church that I'd been at. And that experience nearly killed me, right? Like being the master of the ringleader, right? Mm. The circus ringleader, spinning the plates, having every single aspect of the church, having my fingerprint on the design of everything that happened, yeah. Right? Leading in a way that in retrospect, I can see now as infantilizing of people. Because I led by giving people a script. Here's what you need to do. Here's how to have this be successful. Here's how to have a new person walk in and experience this as really wonderful so they'll want to come back. And people would do that, but then it also meant they weren't acting out of their own spiritual creativity. They weren't having to troubleshoot and solve problems, which is how we learn and grow. And so, you know, it created a machine that looked effective, that grew, you know, the church grew. We had, you know, 80% participation in our small groups. You know, we had great children's ministry. We had, you know, 5 staff. We had all this stuff. It was all happening and it was crushing me, you know, and that's a little bit of the story that I tell in The Wisdom of Your Heart,
yeah.
Where I ended up in a place where I was a functional depressed person on the force of will, being incredibly effective and productive 3.5 days a week, and then being unconscious in bed, unable to function as a human being or a father of 2 young children or a married man for 4.5 days a week or whatever the math is. And, you know, that damaged my family. It damaged my relationship with my wife. It impacted ministry. It led to really wonderful people graduating my church because they needed to have more spiritual freedom and autonomy than I was available to give to them. And so they needed to go other places in order to continue growing, you know, and that happened enough, you know, and it was painful. And so I went through a brutal process of having to face all this, you know, some accountability, some close friends who could see me in ways that I didn't want to be seen. Hmm. You know, a really significant retreat for pastors that were burning out, then getting into therapy for 6 years and doing very hard work about my story and the cocktail of my life and having to basically start my marriage over in terms of trust building, you know, and all of this. And so now we're, you know, 10 and 12 years on the other side of that. And that limp, I can't function in the way that I did before.
Right.
Right. That limp is now a defining element of my ministry. And so how is Bridge City the way that it is? Well, Bridge City graciously went on this journey with me.
And now, a word from a sponsor.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying some new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
So it came on the
side of like burnout and pain, suffering, like being unable to continue to live and pastor in the way that you were.
Yeah.
Which it sounds like then did ultimately, you know, there's another conversation about how, you know, how people in your church experienced 2003, Mark, right? Mm-hmm. There's that conversation. And I'm not to bypass or not see those people, but for you now, it was a severe mercy to come to the end of like what that mark could accomplish and do.
Yeah, a severe and life-saving mercy. If I had tried to continue on then the way that I was, that train was going off the cliff. You know, what it would have been, the loss of my family or the loss of my sanity or the destruction of the church or who knows what, you know. I mean, I was, you know, at one point I was, you know, millimeters away from, you know, cash out the bank account and fly to Mexico and never be seen again. Oof. Right. That's the only possible way for me to get out from under this, you know, and because of gracious people and because of strong, gracious people, right? One of our elders at that time, who's still an elder now, is an experienced long-term trauma therapist. And because of his life experience and his own trauma, he could see me in ways I couldn't see myself and in ways I didn't want to be seen by folks, right? And he was able to be both gracious and strident with me about what was ahead. You know, we had conversations that basically were, Mark, do you want to live or die? Like, that's what's ahead of you, right?
Yeah, what a grace it is to have somebody in your life like that.
Yeah.
You know, and it takes a lot of, it's a lot of, for some of us, it's a lot of labor to do that. It takes a lot of courage to do that. And we don't always get... You know, the only thing maybe harder than summoning the courage to do that is to do it and for it not to work, you know, for the person that you love not to say yes to the lifeline of help you're offering them.
Right.
So now you're pastoring this church and you mentioned you're unsure about whether if you're just sort of chaplaining this church to have a good end, you know, at some point, or if this is, if there's more building and growing to do. But I am curious, like, just, you know, I'm a pastor and, how is pastoring right now for you? Like, taking sort of the big picture out of it, that you're a different kind of pastor of the different kind of church, like 2025 is a pretty, like the news cycle's just bonkers, man.
Yeah.
And things are happening right and left. And I think I'm caught up and then something else happens and I'm like, gosh, how is the social, cultural, political climate in the U.S.? How does it impact your church and where you're at?
Yeah, it is hard for sure. There is a baseline of anxiety that is much higher for everyone than I've ever seen before. You know, every service that we have ends with a time of prayer for people that want prayer. And I would say a week doesn't pass that somebody doesn't ask for prayer for their own mental state in regard to the state of the world, you know, and questions about how do we respond and what can we do? And it's all feels so overwhelming. It feels like we couldn't even make a difference. So that's very present. We are small enough and have gone through a number of kind of filtering events that we've had pretty good unity that I know many of my colleagues don't have. Because when I went through what I went through, one of the things, so I fully expected to be invited to leave. Right. Given the level of unhealth that I was in, I fully expected that it would be appropriate for them to ask me to not be the pastor.
Yeah.
And that's not what happened. They came around me and provided support and encouragement. they, you know, they evaluated the leadership structure of the church, asking how the leadership expectations might have contributed to what had happened. Like, it was an incredible gift of grace. But one of the things that came out of that was I knew they knew what was up with me. Like, that had come out. And I knew that that meant I could not stand in front of people in any way other than absolute truth and vulnerability. Not inappropriately, right? Like, not self-therapizing in the form of a sermon.
Sure.
But being truthful about where I was at. And that was a filtering moment for us, because there were folks who, they don't want a leader up front to be struggling. They don't want to hear a leader say, these songs that are on the list for us to sing today are incoherent for me to sing. I cannot sing them in any other way than aspiration. And if you are in that same place, I see you, right? Well, that's not the kind of worship leading language people are used to. And so, you know, folks left. And it kind of filtered us down to a group where authenticity was an important value. Hmm. And then further along, you know, that led to other conversations that invited those, you know, that level of authenticity. So several years after that, our church decided to have a conversation about how we as a church were going to posture ourselves towards our LGBTQ siblings. And that was about an 18-month long process. And there were folks that was not something they felt they wanted to be a part of when they came to church. And so they left. And so we had several of those kinds of moments, so that when we get to where we are, you know, let's say the last 3 to 5 years, or COVID, when we get to COVID, we have a pretty high level of unity, not necessarily around all having kind of the same worldview or same politics, but having practiced this kind of authenticity, that it's okay to not be resolved. It's okay to have questions. It's okay to not all agree with the pastor. You know, like, that became a value for us. And so, coming out of COVID and into this particular manifestation of the American empire, you know, it didn't split us in the way that, you know, many churches kind of split over political lines. We've had one unexpected, very painful family leave because of language that I used that they felt like was hurtful and exclusionary. You know, I referred to the current presidency as a regime, and they didn't like that word. And we weren't able to work through that conversation, and they left. And that was completely, it completely took me by surprise that you know, that they would both feel that way, but that also they wouldn't trust our capacity to work through that conversation in a constructive and healing way. Hmm. You know, and so that was my one experience of what you're talking about. But as a whole, I think it's just been a lot of confusion, you know, that folks in our church who are lifelong Christians are wondering, why is it that the folks who raised me to believe that who you are behind closed doors is ultimately the thing about you that matters most, that living with integrity matters to the kingdom of God, that the ends justifying the means is not an acceptable way for Christians to behave. How is it that the people who taught me that are so taken by that way of seeing the world right now, right? There's a lot of pain around that. Loss, not necessarily even like families splitting, as you often hear, but just people being confused. Like, how is it that the folks who taught me to see the world this way seem to have abandoned that?
Yeah. So there's a sense of, you mentioned like the baseline of anxiety has gone up. And then there's a sense of like betrayal or abandonment.
Yep. That's exactly it.
Yes. Yeah. I feel that too. And the closest thing I can compare it to, Mark, is when I was like 7, my parents got divorced. Mm-hmm. And I felt like my parents quit on their marriage before I did.
Hmm.
They left something that I wasn't ready to leave, which was our family living in one house together.
Yeah.
And I didn't have any say in it. but it impacted me.
Right.
And it, so a decision was made that I didn't like without my consent.
Right. Yeah, exactly right.
Right. And it, and I felt powerless to impact that decision, and it profoundly impacted me. Right.
Yeah.
And that's the closest analogy I have to what I've experienced over the last 8 years, 9 years.
Yeah, I think that's a really brilliant analogy. I think that sense of feeling powerless is really central to this question, you know, which is an interesting, it raises interesting questions for people who follow the way of Jesus. It reveals something interesting, right? That followers of Jesus would enter into a season where they feel powerless, and that would be awkward and different and uncomfortable, right? Mm-hmm. Where in reality, it has been the state of most followers of Jesus, and indeed most humans historically, that they lived in circumstances that they felt powerless. And most of our Christian forebearers and ancestors had to find a way of living their life of faith, following the crucified one, in a world that felt like ongoing crucifixion. And yet you and I live in a world where our native Christian faith has not felt like crucifixion.
No.
Right? Like in youth ministry eras, when I was in high school, there was a lot of energy around us being told to be zealous for Jesus and to not be afraid of the persecution we would experience, you know, at public school for saying, you know, this is the era of DC talk, Jesus freak, right? You know, like you need to stand up. And, you know, I even remember that there was like a youth version of something that was kind of equivalent to Fox's Book of Martyrs that came out.
Oh, it was from Voice of the Martyrs. The book was called Jesus Freak.
That's it, right?
Yeah.
And so there was this very clear narrative that to truly follow your faith is to be willing to be persecuted. Yes. But in reality, nothing in our life was persecution at all, not even remotely, you know? And we folks of my kind of middle America, you know, middle class, people who look like me, you mm-hmm. know, we've largely lived our life of faith in a way where it didn't feel like we were participating in the suffering of Christ. Right. And so now we are in a world where that's very much on the table. And it feels uncomfortable to the point that we're flailing about trying to change it, trying to figure out what to do so that we don't have to feel this discomfort anymore. Hmm. You know, when in reality, the way of Jesus has always been an invitation to the cross. The cross is an instrument of death. At the very least, it's an instrument of the death of ego. And maybe it means more in terms of loss of comfort and the way that you're used to living. And so there's something very revelatory going on right now, I think. You know, this binary is unfair. I will say that, you know, humans never reduce down to two easy things. But I think that part of the revelation is this sort of separation between folks who can see a way to follow Jesus that doesn't involve the cross and folks who are realizing that following Jesus involves the cross. You know, and, you know, golly, a big giant stage with cool lights and stage smoke and a 15-person band and a choir and an edifying 45-minute message is way more fun than the cross.
Right. Yeah. So then, I mean, one of the things I want to chat about is, Mark, is just where you've been in ministry, where we are as a country. And, you know, you've got a second edition of your book on journaling that's coming out. The reason why is because I think we need ways into connecting with ourselves, connecting with God, and staying grounded and connected to what's really going on in the world.
Yes, right.
And for me, journaling is one of the best ways to do that. Because I can't write as fast as I can think.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
don't know if you have the same issue, but my brain works way faster than my hand. And so I actually have to be mindful about each letter. Mm-hmm. And I'm a horrible speller. I'm kind of screwed without spell check. And it's something I do with my hand. I have to, because I don't write very often, when I write with a pen, my hand will start hurting, cramp up a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
But it's also a way for me to slow down. I have to slow down because I can't physically write faster than, you know, my hand won't let me. Mm-hmm. Slow down, be embodied, connect with God, be grounded where I am.
Yeah.
And you mentioned to me before we hit record that in your first edition, you received some feedback about how hard it was for people to be silent. Mm-hmm. Can you just say more about that feedback and then how you've tried to like respond to that?
Sure. Let me back up a second and lead into that. I think journaling, my experience is that journaling is really probably the most consistently effective spiritual discipline. That's a weird sentence, right? Are spiritual disciplines supposed to be effective? Are they supposed to accomplish something? But what I mean by that is that journaling enables something that I think all spiritual disciplines are really about. I think in the most simplistic sense, all spiritual disciplines are about practicing being present to God. Hmm. So whatever your discipline, memorize scripture, worship, service, like if you're not, you're either doing it to accomplish something spiritual, right? To add to your resume.
Right.
Or if you're not doing that, then what are you doing? Well, you're practicing being present to the pervasive presence of the Spirit of God, which is something, because of the kind of rush that you talk about, we are not skilled at. And so I think every spiritual discipline is ultimately about that. I think journaling helps us do that very well because of the things you immediately talked about. Journaling as a tool set forces you to slow down. It forces you to be present. Yeah. And what you're doing is you're reflecting. And that's the thing. Right? That's the thing that matters. You're reflecting. So like if you think back to the narrative I shared about my journey in ministry, the key points of transformation in that story were all moments of reflection. Right?
Right.
Where I had to think about who I am. I had to think about why I am how I am. I had to think about the disparity between my idealized intentions of who I wanted to be and what was actually happening in the ways of my life. Paul Young uses a phrase that I think is very instructive, where he talks about spiritual maturity being the process where the way of your being comes into alignment with the truth of your being. Right, that ontologically we are something in Christ. We are one way in Christ. That is, you know, Paul talks about this kind of, you know, binary, the flesh and the new man, or who you were before and who you are in Christ. Well, ontologically, this is who you are, but the way you're living is not that. You are living in a way that's rooted in all these drives, like I shared in my own story. Right, my life was formed by the need to show you that I was worth my existence.
Yeah.
And so I'm striving and I'm doing all of these things that look great from the outside, but they are essentially to prove to my own heart that I am worthwhile.
Yes.
Well, my ontology is that I am worthwhile.
Yes.
My ontology is that the Creator made me and is present with me and in me and works in and through me and pervades my life. That is my ontology. But my way of living is often not in alignment with that, right?
Right.
And so reflection, in whatever way you do it, helps you see that and engage that and choose again in an ongoing way to participate in that. And I think that's why journaling is so effective, because journaling basically sets up a framework where you are doing that kind of reflection.
We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Glorify, the number one Christian daily devotional app. Everything around us changes. God doesn't. That's why I love Glorify's 21-day challenge. It helps me build a simple habit of meeting with God every day. No pressure, just consistency. With Glorify, you can start your morning by reading the Bible passage of the day, diving into Glorify's daily devotional, and wrapping up with an immersive experience called Daily Walk with God. And if you need to take a few minutes to yourself in the middle of a busy day, try one of Glorify's guided meditations or listen to their curated worship playlists for some quiet reflection. To end the day, enjoy Glorify's sleep meditations to help you wind down and put your mind and heart at ease. Whether you're a committed Christian or simply curious about faith, Glorify has something for you. Join over 20 million people who have downloaded the Glorify app and deepened their relationship with God. Listeners to the show can get full access to Glorify for just $29.99 for the entire year. That's Glorify's lowest price ever when you download the Glorify app now at glorify-app.com/redcircle. Feel closer to God this year with Glorify. Get full access all year for just $29.99 at glorify-app.com/redcircle. That's glorify-app.com/redcircle.
Do your knees make you feel older than you are? You're out here trying to have a hot girl summer at 35. You're on dating apps. You're saying yes to spontaneous trips. Maybe you're rediscovering your flexibility, and your knees are like, actually, we'd like to quit. The IncrediWear Infrared Knee Sleeve uses fabric tech designed to increase blood flow and help reduce pain and speed recovery, so your knees can actually keep up with your life. It's like giving your body the support it already wants while it heals, just without all the extra pain and drama. Wear it to the gym. Wear it on a date. Wear it while you're doing things I cannot say on this podcast. It's comfortable, breathable, and works 24/7. Go to freesocks.com and grab the IncrediWear knee sleeve and a free pair of socks with purchase. That's freesox.com. Because if something's going to give out, let it be him, not your knees.
Let's get back to the show. One of the axioms that we talk about in our book is God meets us in our messy reality. Mm-hmm. And the first version of that axiom was God is so real, he most fully meets us where we really are. Mm. And part of what reflecting does is it excavates and uncovers how God is present and at work, even when we can't perceive it in the moment.
Yeah. You
know? Because it's not always immediately obvious to us.
Right.
In the moment.
Right. Yeah. And even, you know, depending on the kind of church you grew up in, you might have a particular template in mind for what has to happen for you to sense God's presence, right? You have to have certain experiences, some, you know, goosebumps, a sense of a thought that appears in your mind that you're pretty sure is in yours, whatever, you've got a template. But reflecting long-term, keeping a journal over time actually helps you see the work of God in the moments that don't feel like God's presence. Right. And that is actually most of our lives.
Yes. Right.
At least for me, yes. I did not grow up in a church, you know, template, a model where I'm seeing God at work in every little thing that's happening around me constantly all the time, you know, and I'm grateful because there's an extra gallon of milk in the fridge that God provided, you know, like that's not the world I grew up in. And so it's very easy for me to feel like God's rarely present in my life, you know, and yet the kind of reflection that I teach invites you to look even at those places that don't seem like God's presence and to wonder with your sacred imagination how God is at work in even those places.
Yes. Yeah. So let me circle that back then to my question about silence. How is that related to what you're describing? And what's different about this version of the book that relates to silence?
So we have this statement, you know, us church kids that we heard growing up about God's voice, you know, from the Old Testament story of the prophet of God speaking, you know, in a whisper, right? God wasn't in the tornado. God wasn't in the explosion of the mountain. God was in the still small voice. And I think that's a pretty good frame of reference because, it is hard to hear or to notice God's presence when your sensory apparatus is full of the other presences in your life, right?
Yes.
you know, I mentioned earlier before we were recording that my family did a little trip to Central Oregon. And so we were camping in a campsite that's pretty rural. You know, we're way outside the light pollution of the cities. And to go outside in the dark of night, you know, deep night, and it's really like black in a way that we don't experience around where I live in Portland. And to look up and to see stars, not just like a few, you know, big ones, but like just the whole sky. Like you can see the Milky Way, you can see the swirls, like you can see all of this. And in our language, in our vocabulary, we look at that and we say this phrase, oh, the stars are out tonight. Well, the stars are always out, friend. they're never not out. So what's different? Well, the light pollution of the day and of the city is gone, and now you can see what's always been there. And I think there's an analogy to our busy minds. Like one of the reasons people have a hard time with silence is that when they try to practice it, the first step is that, well, you silence your environment, right? So, you know, you put your phone on do not disturb, you turn off the media, you find a corner where there's not a lot going on, you kind of silence your environment. That's the first step. And then if you can do that and you sit, what you invariably discover is that your own mind, your conscious perceiving mind, is a cascading waterfall of self-justifying noise. Like all the time. Like you sit for a second, you've quieted your environment, and now your mind is shouting, running around in circles, right? Reminding you of things that 10 minutes ago weren't urgent, but now that you're trying to be silent are urgent, and they have to be dealt with this very second. And oh my God, what about that? And if someone walks in and sees me sitting here, they're going to think I'm doing nothing. And am I the kind of person who's allowed to do nothing? Like that's not okay, right? Like all of a sudden there's this whole very clangy narrative happening. And we Western culture people do not really have a clear distinction between the noise in our head and us. This is, this is an Eastern concept that your thoughts are not you. And you can have thoughts and those thoughts are not you. But it's a very necessary and important concept because all that noise in our mind, it's not your identity. It's a combination of your limbic system and your backstory and your insecurities and your drives and mental habits that you've developed over the course of your life. And all these things are going off and you cannot be quiet. And that is very much like trying to look at the sky in Portland when even in the middle of the night, the sky is never black because there's just light pollution. So much light pollution, right? And the stars are there. They are there, right? And in the same way God is there, you know, this is the ancient apophatic tradition, sometimes called the via negativa, right? Where we begin to think about and experience God through thinking about who God is not and where God is not, right? And so you're looking at those places that don't feel spiritual, that don't feel like God showed up. Can I hear God there? Well, I got to pay attention to them. How do I pay attention to them? Well, silence is the starting point. And quite frankly, for most of us, sitting in silence is a skill. Like it's something we are not practiced at, and it takes practice to begin to learn to do it.
And I think some of us are scared of silence. Like it's terrifying. Like we'd rather do anything but be silent.
And that's the reason, right? That's the reason why it's so hard, because the silence is instructive in really uncomfortable ways. Because if I, you know, here's a superficial example. If I sit down, I'm going to take, you know, 5 minutes of silence before I do my journaling practice. If I sit down to be silent and I hear my kids clomping around upstairs and one of them opens the door to my studio and starts coming down the stairs, and I immediately have this insecurity that's like, if they see me sitting here doing nothing, right, that's going to be justification for them to sit around and do nothing. And that's a weird line of thought, except for it's not, because there is embedded in me this drive to productivity as evidence of my personhood, right? It is the way that Calvinism and capitalism and toxic, you know, self, you know, trauma patterns have woven throughout my character. And so the idea that sitting in silence is not being productive and therefore is a bad thing, that just emerges. Okay, well, that moment of silence where that insecurity comes to the surface, instead of seeing that as a deficit or something to deny, I see it as a moment of the instruction of the Spirit of God. Saying, Mark, isn't that interesting? Have you ever wondered why you feel like if you're not being productive, that somehow you are less than fully human? Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting? Do you think that's of me? Mm. How has that corrupted your view of God? How's that impacted the way that you serve in ministry, right? All of a sudden, if I'm open to embracing that discomfort, it becomes my teacher.
Yes. I think, Mark, as we wrap up here, I think it's that capacity and willingness to embrace discomfort that we need help with.
Right, for real.
I really think we do, because I think we relate to discomfort in a myriad ways. But having maybe a guide or a mentor that walks us into discomfort with us and helps teach us or guide us on how to embrace that, how to sit with it, how to stay with it, how to face it, rather than deny it or fix it or numb it or, you know, run away from it. And, you know, I'm excited to talk to you about this journal again, or this book on journaling again, because I think you do that in the pages of this six-week journal. Mm-hmm. I just think it's, you really can kind of give yourself over. It's like in my tradition, we pray prayers that are written. We pray other prayers too, but we pray a lot of prayers that are written. And it's like you give yourself over to words that may have the faith you don't, or may lead you into places that you didn't know you needed to go. And it's something very similar, I think, in the work you're doing with this book. So I just commend it again to our listeners. I know this is an updated version, a second edition. It's out now. Mm-hmm. And we'll put all that information in the show notes. But it's called Journaling for Spiritual Growth, 6 Weeks to Build a Habit that Fosters Spiritual and Emotional Maturity. Mark, thanks for being with us again.
I'm so thrilled to have this conversation, Matt. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. Also, Ben and I hang out there a lot. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. And we'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.